some place I have never seen before. You are sitting down at the head of a long table, and there are bowls and platters piled high with food. You look old, Mama, and your hair is mostly gray. You seem different, happy. Who else is there? Suzette was careful not to disturb the stream of her daughter's glimpsing. Every chair around the table is taken, with a smaller table off to the side. A children's table. I see you, Jérôme, and me. Mère Elizabeth is at the big table, sitting at the other end. Madame d'Orlys is there, too, talking to a light-colored man with big teeth and a wide smile, and some other people I do not know. It is mixed up. You and Mamère are sitting down, but there is a white man sitting, too, friendly, holding a baby. Jérôme is standing laughing. He is much taller than now. And another baby. No. At least two more babies. Is Palmyre there? No, Maman. I don't see Palmyre or Grandpère Gerasim anywhere in the room.
Narcisse Frédieu and his delicate young wife, Tranquillin, came to the farm that evening, as they did one or two times each week, to share supper and evening entertainment with Aureline and Joseph Ferrier. Suzette cooked a turtle stew, and Philomène helped serve. Clearing away the dishes between the entree and the dessert, Suzette noticed how prosperous Narcisse looked alongside Ferrier, how smooth and free of calluses his hands were. Narcisse dominated the supper table with his big laugh and self-assured voice. After supper, the two couples retired to the front room, along with the children. Ferrier brought out the tiles, and he and Narcisse began to play Maroc, while Aureline and Tranquillin embroidered by the fireplace, trading Cane River gossip. Tranquillin was a Creole woman of the back country, with gold-flecked hair and a heart-shaped mouth, good-naturedly quiet. She came from a reasonably good family and was younger than Narcisse by at least 10 years. Suzette put the dishes in to soak and sent Philomène to serve the coffee. No sooner had the girl left the kitchen than she noticed that Philomène had forgotten to put the liqueur on the tray. Suzette grabbed the bottle by its thin neck and hurriedly followed close on the heels of her daughter. "Café?" Philomène said as she entered the front room, hands full. Suzette turned the hallway corner just in time to see Narcisse give Philomène a distinct look of possessiveness. Suzette began silently to count off her blessings. "Philomène is with me. Palmyre is near. Jérôme is not in the field. Mère Elizabeth is healthy." She repeated them over and over in her head, to keep the threatening black fog at a distance. But as she helped Philomène serve, she couldn't rid herself of the lingering sour taste that lodged itself at the back of her mouth. On Sunday, Suzette, Philomène, and Palmyre took the shortcut through the woods instead of the road to Narcisse Frédieu's farm. They could make good time, less than an hour if they walked briskly. The permission pass for the three of them was well worn, pressed against the flesh under Suzette's blouse.
"Will Papa come with Madame d'Orlys, Mama?" Philomène asked, holding fast to Palmyre, swinging their linked hands between them.
"You ask me? You who looks to the future? All I know is that she said she'll bring Jérôme."
Suzette smiled in anticipation.
"Today would be even better if Père Gerasim could come. But we'll see him next month when they bring him to play for the soirée of Monsieur Narcisse."
Gerasim was 4 hours north toward Cloutierville by foot. They walked to see him when they could, which wasn't often. The distance was great, and his hip was too damaged for him to walk to them. He had been sold to Hippolyte Herzog, the brother of the man who had bought Rosedew.
"Mama, will you tell one of your stories?" Philomène asked.
Suzette hesitated, but only for a moment. Whichever direction they took on their travel Sundays, whether to the Frédieu farm or walking to the Herzog plantation to visit Gerasim, Suzette could bring herself alive again.
"Did I ever tell you about the Christmas party on Rosedew?" she began.
Philomène dropped Palmier's hand and ran far enough ahead to face the two sisters. Reverse walking and deftly dodging pine trees at her back, she pantomimed Gerasim playing the fiddle, then became Elizabeth picking up her skirts to dance, and back to Gerasim throwing a broad wink. Palmier smiled and nodded, and Philomène laughed. It seemed the only time either of them was playful was with each other.
"Tell it again, Maman! Don't leave anything out!"
Philomène pleaded, taking up Palmier's hand again. When they reached Narcisse Frédieu's farm, they turned south at the clearing around the farmhouse and headed out back. Narcisse owned only 6 slaves. There were only 2 cabins, hardly a quarter at all, both rough-and-tumble one-room houses. Elizabeth came out on the stoop of one of them to greet the visitors. Wisps of coarse white hair peeked out from under her tignon.
"Rest yourselves on the porch," she said. "I already put some fresh greens from the patch on, and fatback."
Elizabeth looked appraisingly at Philomène.
"Go on and get the comb. Let me fix that pretty hair," she said, and Philomène disappeared inside the cabin.
Elizabeth sat on the porch chair, and when Philomène came out to sit at her feet, her back to Elizabeth's knees, Elizabeth clamped her thighs on either side of the girl's shoulders. She unbraided Philomène's 2 plaits, ran the comb through her long chestnut hair from scalp to tip, and began to rebraid, and they all talked of small things. Mid-morning, in a cloud of dust, Doralise and Geron arrived in Doralise's buggy. Geron dropped the reins, helped Doralise down, and waited by the buggy until she adjusted her skirts and angled her open umbrella against the sun. They all stood, and it took all of Suzette's willpower not to run to her son and fling her arms around him. Instead, she memorized each change since she had last seen him. Geron had grown almost a foot taller. Both his body and face had filled out, and he had the beginnings of a thin mustache. He looked healthy and well-fed, a striking, honey-brown boy, quiet, with trouble-avoiding eyes. Elizabeth offered Doralise the porch chair.
"I brought Geron to visit," Doralise said, once more arranging her skirts as she sat. "His pass is to stay the night, but he needs to be back before dark tomorrow."
"Can we offer you cool water?" Elizabeth asked.
"Merci," Doralise replied. "Let me just find a bit of shade before I am on my way."
Geron stood by the buggy while Philomène fetched a gourd full of water and brought it back to the porch. Doralise whispered to Philomène, Philomène whispered back, and Suzette saw a small article exchange hands and disappear into Philomène's apron pocket. Doralise drained the water and stood.
"I will be going now," she said.
"Madame,
I want to thank you for bringing Geron,"
Suzette told her, hurrying to her side.
"He misses all of you.
Madame, can I ask what passed between you and Philomène?"
"Just a little rock Clement found and thought she might like." "He's only a field hand, madame."
"They seem devoted, Suzette,"
Doralise replied firmly.
"After all this time."
Suzette shrugged.
"I will continue to look after Geron," Doralise said to Suzette, and Geron helped her back up into the buggy.
After Doralise had clicked the horse on its way, Geron joined them on the porch. It took a while before they could stop touching and hugging him. One raw gray morning in the fall of her 3rd year on Ferrier's farm, Suzette heard her name called from Parmire's cabin. She had spent the night on a chair in the children's room, nursing Aureline's son, waiting for his fever to break. Ferrier's shout was insistent.
Suzette!
Suzette dropped the firewood she was carrying into the kitchen and rushed outside. When she got to the door of the cabin, breathless, Ferrier was pulling on Palmyre's arm, trying to get her up from her pallet. His face was knotted with frustration. It was harvest, and he had been coiled tight all week, pushing hard at Suzette and Palmyre as well as himself to get the crop in. Palmyre was still on her pallet, looking unsteady and dazed, but when she saw Suzette behind Ferrier, she motioned for her to come close. A rank smell overpowered Suzette as she approached her sister. Palmyre brought both of her hands up to her temples and squeezed at her head, twisting her face in pain, and then she put both hands on her stomach as if to vomit again. She reached out to Suzette, her hands so contracted that it looked like a bird's claw, and drew one of Suzette's hands to her chest, guiding it in fast pats. Her eyes were deep in their sockets, and she looked panicky. It was as if the very flesh on her face had shrunk overnight. Suzette turned to Ferrier, keeping hold of her sister's dry hand.
"I have to take care of her, Monsieur Ferrier. She's sick. Palmyre never gets sick," Suzette said, rising.
"I cannot spare anyone today. We have to get the crop in," Ferrier said without hesitation. "Call Madame Aureline."
"Please, monsieur, no one is like I am with Palmyre. Let me stay."
"Go get Madame Aureline," Ferrier repeated.
Suzette let go of Palmyre's hand and ran to the house.
"Madame, come quick," she called. "Palmyre is in a desperate way."
Aureline threw on her wrap over her nightgown without doing her morning toilet and followed Suzette to the cabin. Palmyre had already passed into a fitful sleep.
"She is sick right enough," Ferrier said to his wife as she came into the cabin. "You have to spare Philomène from the house today. She comes to the field with us. Can you look after Palmyre?"
"Of course," said Aureline, and to Suzette, "I will do what I can for her. Go on now."
In the field, Suzette worried all day.
Philomène, unaccustomed to crop labor, stumbled often in the fierce heat between the rows of cotton, and Suzette couldn't erase the image of Palmyre's terrified face when she had reached out her hand to her that morning.
When at last the sun began to lower in the sky, Ferrier let them come in, hot and sweaty. Suzette rushed to the cabin, and as her eyes became accustomed to the darkness, she saw first Aureline in a chair beside the bed, and then the unnatural color of Palmyre's face and body. Her sister had turned a leaden blue, dark and mottled. Palmyre's skin was wrinkled and folded, as if she were an ancient woman, and her breathing was ragged and uncertain. Palmyre turned her head slightly and vomited, but there was no longer any food in her to bring up. What came up was like rice water.
"She just gets worse," Aureline said, looking to Suzette.
Suzette came closer and took a rag to wipe her sister's mouth. When Suzette touched her jaw, Palmyre's mouth flew open. Her tongue looked like a dead fish. Suzette turned to Philomène.
"There's tasso you can heat up for supper," she instructed, "and make some biscuits with cane syrup. Go!"
Philomène ran toward the farmhouse.
"I can take over now, madame," she said to Aureline. "I did what I could for her."
Looking miserable, Aureline left Suzette and Palmyre alone. Suzette wiped Palmyre's forehead, and when her sister's arms and legs began to spasm uncontrollably, she massaged them. She tried to get Palmyre to connect with her, to meet her eyes and challenge the sickness, but she was drifting from listless and unaware to coma. Palmyre never regained consciousness and died that night, fast from one sundown to the next. It wasn't until the next day they found out that on the Frédieu farm, Narcisse's wife, Tranquillin, had been stricken with the same symptoms as Palmyre's, ending in the same abrupt death coma. Cholera had come to Cane River. after Palmyre died, Suzette was no longer certain she could resist the pull of the black fog. Philomène found her way to Suzette's side as often as she could, coaxing Suzette to tell her stories, anything to get her talking. But it was all Suzette could do to keep moving and do her work. She tried to hold on for Philomène's sake. She wanted to reach out and stroke the girl's hair, to tell her something important about how to protect herself. But it was too much effort, and she didn't have anything worthwhile to say. Suzette was vaguely aware that Philomène took on many of her own chores. Philomène got up before dawn, filled the woodboxes with kindling, lit fires in the chilly bedrooms in the morning and evening, washed and ironed the clothes, parched the coffee, and stoked the fires at night while Aureline's family slept. She cooked, fetched water and milk from the spring house, and meat from the smokehouse. She bathed, diapered, dressed, groomed, and entertained Aureline's infant children. She spun thread and picked seeds from the cotton, gathered eggs, plucked chickens, and drove cows to and from the woods. When Suzette went to the field, Philomène toted water to her and Ferrier before heading back to the house, where she would comb Aureline's hair, lace her corset, and arrange her hoop skirts. Philomène tried to get Suzette to imagine happier days off in the future. But when Suzette thought about Philomène's glimpsing of the long table piled high with food when they were all together again, she remembered who wasn't there. Not Palmyre. Not Gerasim. Suzette's old dreams of white dresses, St. Augustine, and freedom for her children had proven to be senseless and unreachable. The future was too heavy for her to carry. It was up to Philomène now. Part 2. Philomène. Chapter 11. Philomène Dora turned the corner of the house on Ferrier's farm, with her long-limbed stride, her careless hair flying behind her. The beginning weight of the baby made her body seem different, foreign. Looking down at her forearms exposed below the cuff of her thin gingham blouse, she could see that the Louisiana sun had already turned the ivory-yellow color of her winter skin to the deep olive she became in summer. Her arms were muscular and firm from the constant demands of heavy farm work, and her body was a woman's body, caught up at last to the mind that had always seemed mature. She was fully aware of the danger that accompanied the emergence of her high breasts and rounded hips, and thanks to her man Clément, she also understood the pleasures. They were to be married in front of the priest in just 5 days. She would have jumped the broom, if that was the best she could have made happen, but she wanted something like the real ceremony the white people had, the way her marraine, Doralise, had done it. It was well past first light. Philomène had stuffed her tignon in her apron pocket as she hurried out of the cabin, intending to capture her hair when she wasn't so behind schedule. She was on her way to the henhouse to collect eggs for preparing breakfast, and her focus was on the task before her, as always. It was the way she had with everything, putting herself into it mind and body, without a spare thought or motion, until she turned herself to the next thing to be done. She had to blink against the strong sun, still so low in the sky that the side of the house had blocked its glare until she had almost fully passed the front gallery. Before she even saw him there, she could feel his eyes on her. Narcisse Frédieu. He had always watched her, for as long as she could remember. She had grown up with those eyes always on her. In the beginning, the watching had been just another condition of her existence, like emptying the stink pots, or obeying Aureline's orders, or the unchangeable fact that Monday was bake day. At some point, she couldn't recall exactly when, she had begun to sense the singular nature of his watching, and only then had it made her uneasy. Over the years, she had added strands of different impressions, until they formed a dense, complicated knot of fear and anger, challenge and loathing, that she carried from place to place, deep in the core of her stomach, not unlike the way she carried the baby now. Narcisse supplied different faces to the watching. One day it showed itself as fascination, on another day, open desire, on still another, domination. No matter the look of the moment, at its base was always a call for submission, so easily recognizable between white and dark. When submission was demanded, the outward signs of submission were always offered. It was a well-polished survival technique, and Philomène used it especially carefully with Narcisse. Even as she bowed her head or rounded her back or averted her eyes with the watcher, she seethed at his right to invade her in this way, as a dangerous game, as a prelude. Anger had no practical or logical expression against a white man, so she tried to ignore the looks he gave her, his tendency to be in the same places she was, all of a sudden, drinking her in. She could remember his first wife dimly, a pasty-faced woman with a soft voice and timid manner. The woman had always looked to Philomène as if the wind could come and blow her to some other place, without the world taking any notice. Mademoiselle Tranquillin died of cholera. They didn't talk about her any more, and Narcisse had started bringing out a new woman when he visited the farm, another of the endless Durbans sprinkled around the Cane River landscape. The new one's name was Mademoiselle Arsine Durban, and she always arrived with a chaperone or two in tow. Narcisse had not brought her along today. He looked to be alone, and early to the farm. He was here too often as far as Philomène was concerned, but her opinion was neither requested nor expressed. Philomène hurried her steps toward the henhouse, as if she didn't know Narcisse was watching. She was careful not to glance in his direction. Narcisse was waiting as she came out of the henhouse, with her apron bunched around the still warm eggs she had gathered to prepare for that morning's breakfast. "You've tied up your hair already, I see." "What a shame," he said, his voice sugary. Philomène stopped several feet away and assumed her pose, aware of Narcisse's deep-set eyes, trying to find an opening.
"Morning, Monsieur Narcisse. I need to get these eggs into the kitchen."
"I understand you want to marry one of Tessier's field boys," he said, brushing aside her remark. "You should have come to me for something so important. You deserve someone better than a field hand. You could do better. I've known your mother and your grandmother since long before you were born. I could help you do better."
"Monsieur, I could do no better than Clément. It is meant to be."
Philomène stared at an imaginary spot to the left of his elbow as she talked, her head not fully bowed. She kept her voice low but even. It would be easier if she could retreat into her mind and be as unaware as her mother sometimes was, or as patient as her grandmother. But her glimpsings made her promises, set her onto the path of intentions, made her too bold.
"I've heard about your gift. What else can you see? Anything for me?"
Narcisse put on a solicitous, playful air, as if he were passing the time with an overindulged child, but his voice betrayed genuine interest and something else, between respect and fear. The Creoles were a superstitious lot.
"No, monsieur. I'm sorry."
"Surely, with all of the powers at your command, you can look to wherever you go for your visions and tell me something that could prove useful for me to know.
Maybe you will have a long and happy life with a new wife," Philomène said.
"You've seen that?"
Philomène could hear the quickening in Narcisse without needing to look into his face.
"No, monsieur. I just hope it for you."
His interest waned, and he came back in a different direction.
"What is it that you see in this boy?"
"His name is Clément. We have known each other since we were children on Rosedew."
"You don't need a boy. You need a man. A man who could protect you."
Protect her from what? Philomène thought. From being a slave? No one could protect her from that. Clement is the only man I need. We will marry. We will have children. They are already on the way. I saw it, and now it is coming to pass. Narcisse went on as if she had not spoken at all.
I told Ferrier that he shouldn't let you marry that boy.
Philomène stood immobile, seeming to study the ground at her feet, but she was shaken. Narcisse had influence over Aureline, but she knew what a stubborn man Ferrier was, not one to give in easily to outside influence, and all of the plans were already set.
Monsieur Ferrier has already given his permission, Philomène said, trying to keep her voice steady. The wedding is Saturday. Monsieur Dora is coming too, to stand up for me.
Philomène included both her owner's and her father's names, as if matching Narcisse's resistance with the mention of two other white men could make him back down, make everything come out all right. She collected herself. She had said too much to Narcisse already. There was no advantage in talking over much.
Will there be anything else, Monsieur Narcisse? They wait on me to prepare breakfast.
I've known your family for a long time. I want what's best for you.
Oui, monsieur.
I will be at the wedding. I have an interest in you. Don't ever forget that.
Oui, monsieur.
You have lovely hair, Philomène. I like to see it free of your scarf.
Oui, monsieur.
You may go.
Wednesday, wash day, Philomène removed a water-weighted bedsheet from the washtub where they had just boiled it clean. Suzette took one end, Philomène the other, and they stretched the white sheet between them, wringing out the excess water. It took both of them to smooth it out so they could hang it to dry.
What do you think about Doralise and Monsieur Eugène? Philomène said in a furtive undertone.
They whispered their wash-day gossip, even though they were out of earshot of the house.
It was just a matter of when she moved out of his house, Suzette whispered back. Not his house. Her house, maman, Philomène said. Or at least, it was. She got him to sign the house over before she ever moved in. She was shrewd.
And not such a young woman anymore either, said Suzette. Philomène added another bundle of clothes to the steaming water.
Ma mère Elisabeth says Doralise knows how to turn a situation around to suit her.
Like a cat. That one lands on her feet, Suzette said. She got Monsieur Dora to get her a divorce, and then she takes up with him in his house, in the open.
Him so full of her pretty ways that he signs over his house and land to her, with her already having land of her own. She snorted, a flat, humorless sound, full of wonder. Philomène glanced up at the look of concentration on her mother's face as she handled the growing mound of white linen. Suzette always seemed to speak of Eugène Dora as a distant stranger, without passion or anger.
Maman, Philomène began cautiously, you carry no grudge against Doralise going with Monsieur Eugène?
That hurt scabbed over almost as long as you've been on this earth. Doralise has my regard. Coming out on the other side of a tangle with a white man with something in her own pocket to show for it.
You never talk about you and Papa.
What Philomène knew about her father, she had learned from her grandmother. She was surprised when Suzette replied.
He moved easy from me to Doralise, without ever looking back. I do not care one way or the other about Eugène Dora, except for what he can do for my children. The only thing he gave me was children closer to white. That makes you better than most. Blood counts, but instead you make babies with a brown-skinned boy, when it is on you to carry this family forward now.
Why do we always go back to that?
My light skin and straight hair and fancy speech does not make me free like Madame Doralise, doesn't get me out from under Madame Aureline. Every morning, I still wake up a mulatto slave.
Philomène used the word mulatto deliberately, although she hated it.
Mules were mixed breeds, too, set apart. You better learn how to hold your tongue, Al. Sometimes you seem to forget which of us is the mother and which is the daughter.
I am sorry, Philomène said dutifully, eyes cast downward, hidden beneath her dark lashes. No disrespect intended, Maman. It was an old argument that couldn't be won.
So is Doralie's family? She prodded.
Oui. She helped when we needed, Suzette said, and made the sign of the cross. Doralie's did more for you and Gérard than Monsieur Eugène ever did. He may be through with her now, but she is still my marraine, and yours.
Suzette poked at the laundry with the wooden paddle and plunged it under the sudsy water.
They hounded them apart, because he put her up in his own house, or her house. You know what I mean. They don't like to see that around here.
Who is they, Maman?
White, black, colored, free, slave. Nobody likes it. Monsieur Eugène was crazy to think he could just move a colored woman, free or not, into his own house in the daylight and not pay. And white folks expect land to flow to their own. They cut him out then, all but a few too fond or too old to care. The ones who sheltered him in the beginning are all dead now. Doralie's knew from the start, getting him to give her the house before he got worn down. White men always choose the same way in the end.
You ask about grudges, Suzette went on.
What good are grudges?
Doralie's went with the man for her own reasons.
She is still like family, although there's nothing we can do for her. She is the one who is free.
Philomène listened politely, showing her mother the silent respect age entitled her to. She didn't agree at all about grudges. It was important to keep an accounting of rights and wrongs, even if there was nothing to be done about them right away, even if there was nothing that could ever be done.
Could you have stopped Monsieur Eugène from coming for you?
You go too far, girl.
They worked in silence until Suzette broke it.
What got you asking about Eugène Doha and me now?
I have a white man looking at me. Philomène pushed the words out. He puts his eyes on me, like the next step is his hands. He comes at me out of nowhere, throwing his big shadow and blocking the light.
Narcisse, Fred Dieu.
Suzette pursed her lips and shook her head.
I see him sniffing around. He say anything direct.
He said Clément is not good enough for me, that he could help me do better. He said he talked to Monsieur Ferrier about calling off the marriage ceremony.
I heard them last night while serving. Monsieur is not going to let Narcisse Frédieu or anyone else come on his place and tell him what to do. You and Clément are as good as married.
It has to be more than as good as. What if that man comes to me in the night? He has it in his mind.
You stay out of his way as much as you can.
But what if he forces himself on me? What can I do?
Suzette averted her eyes from her daughter, and when she finally spoke, she was brusque. You asked the wrong person.
Chapter 12. Philomène heard the whippoorwill call as she patched a frayed shirt collar of Ferrier's in the farmhouse. She threw aside her mending and hurried into the children's room. Little Josephina was heavy in sleep. Aileen's daughter had settled some in her breathing. The thimbleful of brandy was having an effect. Philomène smoothed the girl's sandy hair from her face, rearranged the blanket, and gave her one last glance. The whippoorwill call sounded again. She raced to the back door of the farmhouse and saw Clément, tousled and sweaty, waiting for her just beyond the clearing. His shirt had mud splotches down one sleeve, and one leg of his homespun trousers was shorter than the other, but he grinned widely and raised a palm skyward in salute. The upturned palm was an old signal between the two of them from Rosedew.
Then it had meant, I'm here, you're there. but we'll manage to be together later.
Philomène raised her palm in response and broke into a run to him. She hurled herself into his arms.
I cannot stay away from the house for long, she said, breathless, looking back anxiously toward the farmhouse. The girl has a cold and is sleeping. I gave her a little brandy.
I only have a short while myself. I took a detour in making this delivery to Monsieur Narcisse. I took a chance you'd be here.
If the little one hadn't gotten sick, that is where I would be now along with the rest, visiting on Monsieur Narcisse's place, Philomène said, leaning into Clement. Maman went too. They will not return until after supper.
I had to see you, Clement said.
His arms around her waist, he lifted her until her feet no longer touched the ground.
Put me down!
Philomène backed away from Clement, laughing.
You're wet,
she said, looking up from his bare feet to the water line at the knee on his trousers. The force of a frisson, a small chill, passed through her, and she shivered. That leaky boat doesn't belong on the water.
I'm good with the boat, Clement boasted. As long as I have bailing gourds, I can outsmart the river every time. Monsieur Tessier doesn't trust anyone else with that one. She's tricky. It saves 2 hours of walking getting to you.
Philomène frowned.
The river was in a playful mood today, Clement said. I scooped more than I rowed.
He caught Philomène around the middle, pulling her close enough to catch the damp smell of the boat's cypress planks on him.
What mood are you in?
Philomène couldn't prevent herself from smiling.
Clement, is that all you think about?
Close to it, he answered, with a slow, lazy smile. Out in the field, when the sun burns, I think of you. In the stable over the red-hot anvil, I think of you. At night on my pallet, I think of you. You and the baby. The rest doesn't mean anything.
I saw you in a glimpsing last night, Philomène blurted out, and it made me afraid.
The glimpsings do not come as strong as they used to. They are more like feelings than pictures now. But I saw your body cold and still near a river.
Clement let Philomène go and considered her for a long time. He made a visible effort to shake the mood.
Death by drowning is a better death than most, but I don't plan on going yet,
he said simply as he stepped forward and held her again.
At least it won't be smallpox or cholera or yellow jack, or being beaten or starved to death.
Should I have told you? Philomène asked.
Yes, you can always tell me anything, Clement said. Meanwhile, we're here together. Let's go to the shed. I have something to show you.
He carried a stack of skins by the bundler's knot in one hand, and with the other he pulled Philomène close to him by the waist as they walked to the tool shed. It was a small shed, barely big enough to hold the plow, hose, pickaxes, and other tools for the farm, but it had a door, and it was out of the weather. Clement cleared a narrow space on the ground, unknotted the bundle, spread one of the bearskins skin side down on the cold, packed ground, and brought another bearskin and put it skin side up on top of the other.
Get in between.
I want you to feel these skins, he said. Nothing is too good for you.
Clement, what if they find out you use the skins?
They'll never know. Take off your dress first.
Philomène stepped out of her shift and crawled into the shelter he had made for them, and Clement shed his wet pantaloons and shirt and followed. Under the bearskins, he cupped his hands around her bottom and began to move his hands slowly.
What do you have for your brown-skinned boy?
Please do not make fun of Maman Clement. I should never have told you she called you that.
She's come around, Philomène said.
Listen. Mama went to Madame Aureline about you.
She imitated her mother's voice as if she were talking to Aureline.
Monsieur Ferrier is looking mighty tired these days, working out in the field like an animal, putting his hands in the dirt. And we should not be doing all this field work either.
None of us was raised this way. Monsieur Ferrier should have some strong boy out helping him, and Clement is just the one. You should get Monsieur Ferrier to buy him in.
What did Madame Morelin say?
That Monsieur Ferrier already went to Monsieur. Monsieur Tessier does not care to sell.
I thought your mother disapproved of your brown-skinned boy,
Clement said, grinning.
Now what she says is,
the brown-skinned boy is family.
Philomène guided his hand to her stomach.
This changed her mind.
Clement left his hand there and massaged her stomach with his fingertips.
You take too many chances, Philomène said. What if they miss you, or find out you use the skins?
They won't. I made good time on the river coming. I have my pass. I'll head over to Monsieur Narcisse directly and make the delivery, and get back to Monsieur Tessier's without him worrying.
What would I do without you?
Too much talking,
Clement said, and moved his hand from where he stroked the high ridge of her rounding belly lower. Philomène smoothed out under his touch.
You make me feel soft as this fur, she said, sighing. Like if I lean, you can hold the weight.
The strong smell of the tanning chemical still clung to the skin side, but the softness of the fur was intoxicating.
In 3 days we will be married, Philomène said.
They put a marrying suit together for me, mostly from Monsieur Tessier's things, Clement said. I'll do you proud.
Married by a priest, Philomène said drowsily.
Maybe Monsieur Eugène got the priest to come, but that doesn't make it any more legal.
It is as legal as we can get it, Philomène said, her body starting to go tight.
We can't afford to waste our time arguing. These bearskins need to get where they're going.
Clement used his foot to stroke Philomène's leg and gathered the bearskin closer around them.
And we need to get where we're going.
He traced his finger lightly down her cheek, stopping at the corner of her mouth.
Open the gate, gal!
Philomène relaxed again and smiled wide, revealing the evenly spaced gap between her two front teeth.
That's my gap, Clement said, and he kissed her.
Those are my lips, Philomène said, touching his mouth.
He unknotted her tignon, threw it to the side, and used his slim fingers to fluff her long, shiny chestnut hair.
Like corn silk, he said, but thick and wavy deep. I could get lost in it.
She lifted first her lips and then her body to meet his. The Saturday afternoon of the wedding, Philomène delivered herself over to Aureline, while Suzette kept at the baking. For 2 days, Philomène and her mother had been preparing for the party. Philomène sat stock still in Aureline's bedroom, as the mistress herself stood behind, patiently arranging her hair in complicated basket plaits. The room that Philomène swept, scrubbed down, and aired out every day seemed unfamiliar from the chair where she sat as the center of attention. Philomène could hear the steady murmur of voices from the front of the house. The wagons had been arriving since early afternoon.
There, Aureline said, satisfied. You're ready. Stand up. Let me look at you.
Philomène stood uncertainly. Suzette had taken apart an old white muslin dress of Aureline's and made it over, and the hem floated just above the floor over one of Aureline's double steel hoops. The dress had been left a little loose to accommodate her expanding waistline, and the hoop felt awkward, but Philomène was striking. Suzette bustled in at that moment, flush, carrying a tangle of wildflowers.
"Oh, Philomène," she said, circling her daughter slowly. "Is that you? You look beautiful, like a lady."
"Merci, Mama."
Suzette turned to Aureline.
"They're all out there waiting, madame. The priest, Monsieur Eugène, Monsieur Narcisse," she said. Monsieur Ferrier sent me in to say it's time to tend your guests.
Suzette looked down at the flowers she had brought.
These are for Philomène's hair. I could place them.
Good, said Aureline. I am finished with the rest.
You do look beautiful, Philomène.
Merci, madame, Philomène said.
Give me a little time to greet the guests, then come out, Aureline said, and left the room to join the gathering.
Suzette sat Philomène at the dressing table again and began to weave the pale lavender buds and green stems through the thick mass of the basket plaits. Philomène would have been indifferent to her hair were it not for the fact that when people stared at it, they seemed to soften toward her, and Clément seemed mesmerized by it. Philomène's hair was unlike the tight, deep knots and naps of Elizabeth's hair, unlike the springy coils of Suzette's, unlike Gerasim's snaky twists. It was always a challenge to make it behave, and there was always too much of it pushing onto her face and down her back, but Aureline had tamed it today. They looked into the mirror, daughter and mother. Both were small-boned, but where Suzette's face was round and pleasant, the color of cocoa, Philomène's face was angular, her skin smooth and unblemished, even at 14. The eager inquisitiveness that had marked Suzette as a child had been pushed deep inside, far away from view, but a glimmer remained. Philomène was the color of buttermilk biscuits, and the high cheekbones that came down from her grandfather Gerasim seemed caught in a flight to meet the outer corners of her eyes, giving her entire face a confident and determined air.
"Did they all come, Mama?" Philomène asked. "Mère Elizabeth, Jérôme?"
"They all wait on you out there, to see you marry this brown-skinned boy.
Clément, Mama!"
"Clément," Suzette repeated. "There will be a little sleeping tonight. Everyone got overnight permissions. Monsieur just got back from fetching Gerasim to play fiddle at the party."
"I wish Aunt Palmyre could have been here," Philomène said.
"Yes, I miss her too."
Suzette fussed with the flower arrangement in Philomène's hair.
"It would have done her good to see you standing in front of a priest with your man."
"It was meant to be," Philomène said. Suzette took a step back.
"This is a happy day, a day to show off that pretty face. Smile, Philomène."
Philomène obeyed her mother, at first tentatively, but when she caught sight of Suzette's full-to-bursting grin in the mirror, her own smile widened.
"You're mine, all right," Suzette said, staring at the telltale gap between their front teeth that made it easy to spot the connection between these generations of women. "But you have it in you to do better for yourself and the child you carry."
The room became still.
"Come." "It is time," Suzette said, and she gave Philomène a small push out the door and down the hallway.
Philomène took a deep breath and stepped into the Ferrier's dining room. Her thick, corded hairdo made her feel as if she needed to hold her neck stiffly just to keep in balance. About 20 people were collected in the room, white toward the front and colored farther back, and they all stopped talking when she came in. She saw Eugène and Doralise, Narcisse next to Ferrier, Elizabeth and Gerasim, and Clément's mother. Then Philomène saw Clément near the priest from St. Augustine. Clément had on a pair of borrowed black trousers, too long in the leg and patched at the knee. His coat was a heavy, formal one of thick worsted wool, with two long tails that fanned out behind him. It could not have been a better fit, but it was more suitable for the dead of winter weather than summer. The stiff white waistcoat and white cravat made him look the man of distinction. Clément clasped his two hands tightly together in front of him, fingers interlocked, as if he didn't know what else to do with them. Just as Philomène entered the room, he brought up his arm and brushed away the sweat running from his forehead with his sleeve, never once unclasping his hands. He had on a pair of oversized gardening gloves, bleached to blinding white. Philomène had to stop herself from giggling. It was her glimpsing come to life. the white hands, the split up the back. Suzette pushed her from behind toward the priest and Clément.
"Come, stand here," the priest said, looking straight at Philomène,
and she took her place by Clément's side. The priest raised his hand for silence and began to recite the special slave ceremony he had prepared. His voice carried to all corners in the small dining room on Ferrier's farm.
"You, Clément, do now, in the presence of God, and these witnesses, take Philomène to be your wife, promising that so far as shall be consistent with your relation, which you now sustain as servant, you will perform your part of a husband toward her. And in particular, as you shall have your opportunity and ability, you will take proper care of her in sickness and in health, in prosperity and adversity, and that you will be true and faithful to her, and will cleave to her only, so long as God shall continue yours and her abode in such places as you can conveniently come together. Do you thus promise?"
Clément said, "Oui."
"You, Philomène, do now, in the presence of God and these witnesses, take Clément to be your husband, promising that so far as your present relation as a servant shall admit, you will perform your part of a wife toward him. And in particular, you promise that you will love him, and that as you shall have the opportunity and ability, you will take proper care of him in sickness and in health, in prosperity and adversity, and will cleave to him only, so long as God shall continue his and your abode in such places as you can conveniently come together. Do you thus promise?"
"Oui," said Philomène.
"I then, with the consent of your masters and mistresses, do declare that you have license given you to be familiar together as husband and wife, so long as God shall continue your places of abode as aforesaid, and so long as you shall behave yourselves as it becomes servants to do. For you must, both of you, bear in mind that you remain still, as really and truly as ever, your master's property, and therefore it will be justly expected, both by God and man, that you behave yourselves as obedient and faithful servants toward your respective masters and mistresses for the time being."
The priest took a breath.
"Clément, you may salute the bride," he said.
Clément fidgeted, looking to Philomène to give him some clue as to what to do next. Philomène could only give him a helpless shrug.
"You may kiss the bride now," the priest said.
Clément took Philomène's hand in his and brushed his lips quickly across her cheek, grinning sheepishly as he turned to face the room full of people, waiting for the next instruction. And so they were bound together in the eyes of all who attended, as they already had been between themselves for some time, and married, after a fashion, as much as they were allowed to be. Philomène delivered twin girls in the spring, with Aureline attending while Suzette was in the field with Ferrier. The babies were very small, but both seemed healthy. The two girls didn't look alike, except for the similar looks of all newborns, with their jerky movements and changeling features. Clément saw his daughters for the first time on the following Saturday morning, when he rode down to Ferrier's farm. It was Philomène's scheme for the naming. The firstborn was named Elizabeth after her grandmother, and the second twin, Bethany, after Clément's grandmother. They all quickly fell into the Creole custom of taking a part of the birth name for the common name, and in short order they could barely remember the christening names. Elizabeth became Bet, and Bethany became Thaney. Old Elizabeth scolded Philomène for changing Elizabeth to Bet, but she was so pleased with her granddaughter and the dramatic leap by two into the next generation of the family tree that everyone could tell her complaints carried no sting. Chapter 13. The sky was dark, threatening rain, and Clément was anxious to be off before the storm broke. Dressed in his everyday pantaloons and loose shirt, he carried his only pair of shoes wrapped in his Sunday jacket. He hoisted the heavy packet of bearskins over his shoulder, and stopped at Tessier's big house for last-minute instructions. A full season of planting and harvesting and planting again had passed since he and Philomène had married, and today was his day to present her with a real gift. He had gotten permission from Tessier to work on a rocking chair after his own duties were done, and from Ferrier he had permission to allow Philomène to keep the chair. He and Philomène, who were allowed to own nothing by law, not even themselves, would own this. Clément had taken to calling it the moonlight chair, since his labors were more by the light of the moon than by daylight. Tessier, hat pulled low over his head, bushy eyebrows still visible, sat on the front gallery, braiding a horse's leather rein. He bit off a large chaw of rich dark tobacco and stashed it in his cheek before turning his attention to Clément.
"I'm going to trust you to get my boat back to me, boy," Tessier said, using his tongue to adjust the wad in his cheek. "Now, Narcisse Frédieu is waiting on those skins. Starting this early, you should be able to beat the storm coming. You got the pass?"
"Oui, Monsieur Tessier," Clément said in his sing-song slave voice, keeping his head bowed.
"You can count on me like always. I'll look after that boat like it was one of my own baby girls. I'll come rowing back on Sunday night, without it being none for the worse for wear." "So, today your woman sees the chair, eh?"
"Oui, Monsieur Tessier," Clément said.
"I'll count on her surprise.
Thank you for letting me work on it."
"It was your own time, boy, and your money from smithing. Didn't take anything away from me."
For the last 2 years, Clément had been serving as a blacksmith's apprentice. His training came only when he could be spared from the field, but he made good use of what time he had. Mastering the shape of hot metal in the barn gave him a feeling of working his head as well as his body, and a skilled man was more in keeping with the high yellow woman he called his wife. He had earned a little money taking on extra tasks for some of the neighboring farmers in the evenings. The serious jobs went to either the gens de couleur libre, who hired themselves out, or to the regular blacksmith, but an occasional small job came his way that allowed him to save 4 bits here and a few picayunes there. Tessier let him keep half of all he earned and held the money for him.
"You be careful," Tessier said. "The water is rising, and by the look, this one is more than a squall. I don't want to see you lose my boat and get yourself drowned in the bargain. You, the boat, and the furs are worth good money. Get on before the storm takes hold."
He let loose a stream of tobacco juice in the dirt. Clément carried his cargo to the landing and quickly covered the chair, the bearskins, and his extra clothes with an oilskin tarp, lashing them down with a cord around the cypress plank in the back of the dugout. He elevated the packet as high as he could get it away from the water sloshing in the boat bottom, making the narrow dugout harder to balance. Clément struck off, imagining the look that was sure to come over Philomène's face when he brought her the chair. She was the root of his world. Clément hummed to himself, an upbeat melody to challenge the darkening of the morning sky. He pulled at the oars, making his way downriver, recognizing plantations and farms on both banks of Cane River. The river had a bite to it today, giving unexpected tugs in first one direction and then another, as the currents changed. He thought about the months it had taken to make the moonlight chair. Finding the oak wood had been easy, since trees and newly felled branches were plentiful in the woods surrounding the quarter on his plantation. The curves of the supports had been the most difficult for him to master, getting them to come out even, and he had redone them several times before he got it right. When he finished the construction, he painstakingly carved 2 images along the wide back of the chair, the full-faced boldness of a brown bear near the top, and directly underneath, the silhouette of a deer in flight. On the front panel, Clément carved the likeness of an owl. They were all a little more crude than he would have liked, but he was satisfied they could be recognized as what he had intended, and he was sure Philomène would appreciate the effort. The arms of the chair he studded with melted down pieces from used horseshoe nails, and he fitted the bottom of the seat with the hide from one of the cows that ran free in the woods, caught and slaughtered at Tessier's order. Tessier kept the meat from the cow and deducted several bits from the money he held for Clément in exchange for a piece of the hide. Clément cured the skin himself, a stinking job that left his hands tender from the salt brine. He worked by the light of the fire in the evening. The others in the quarter teased him about his moonlight chair as they went off to bed, but there was envy in their voices, too. The dugout lurched. Tessier had been right. The water was rising dangerously, and it was difficult to keep control of the oars. Before he was even halfway down the river, the water started to swirl in strange patterns around him as he paddled. The sky opened suddenly, hurling rain, and the sun vanished behind the clouds at almost the same moment, giving the river a dark and sinister look. Because he had grown up on the river, Clément respected its moods, but he was also confident of his skill with a boat. He pulled strong against the oars. Normally that would have been enough, but the front of the boat kept getting caught up in furious little circular pockets, carrying him in directions he did not intend. Clément started to sweat through his clothes, even though the weather was cool and damp, and he realized that his body was telling him what his head had not yet registered. He was afraid and was having trouble steering to either shore. Landings dotted the river every 100 yards or so, wherever there was a plantation or farm large enough to need access to the river. Although he was always within sight of land, he couldn't get to it. The water moved faster beneath him, and sheets of lightning crackled threateningly around him. Clément tried to scoop water out with the bailing gourds and then his hands, but neither made any difference. He needed to put ashore anywhere he could manage and wait out the passing of the storm. The river slipped from dingy gray to black, now and then becoming so dark that it seemed nighttime, and the storm beat back the sun. At times he could judge his position only during frozen moments when a crack of lightning brightened the sky. By the time the booming echoes followed, Clément was back in the dark. Water began to come rushing at him from every direction, seeping up from below, falling from above, driven from the side by the wind that drove the wet into his face and eyes. Lurching waves brought water in over the low sides of the dugout, as if he were out in open sea rather than on a river. A strong blast of wind blew off one corner of the tarp, leaving it snapping menacingly in the changeling wind. He could hear the play of tarp against wood, tarp against cargo, and the light rope that had held it in place was a dangerous nipping thing at the whim of each sharp gust. The only way to save the cargo would be to bring the boat safely to shore without tipping over in the choppy water, a task advancing in hopelessness as the storm wore on and the waterlogged dugout rode lower in the water. All at once he felt an insistent tug of the water, different from the random tossing he had managed to control so far. Clément looked in front of the boat to his right and saw a suckhole forming, widening in its greed to pull everything it could to its core. He gave up on the idea of being able to save the boat, and in the same instant yielded to a wink of recognition. It was Philomène's glimpsing of the end for him, by water. The thought did not keep him helpless for long. He had no intention of dying just yet, leaving the wife he had always wanted and 2 daughters. If it was his time, it would have to fight to take him. He made his choice, working the chair free from under the tarp by feel, the heavy oilskin and the free end of the rope snapping and lashing at him. It caught him several times on his body. He couldn't distinguish where, but he felt a sharp sting as something caught the soft flesh under his eye, opening him up. It was raw. There was no time to investigate. Standing as high as he dared, and straddling the boat with his feet placed flat against the cypress planks on the side that made up the hull, Clément balanced in the boat
the best he could. He threw the chair as far as his strength and equilibrium would allow. Heart beating wildly, he dove into the cold, rain-pocked river in the same direction as the chair, as far from the drag of the suck-hole as he could get. When he broke the water's surface, his lungs pulling in fresh air that came mixed with blinding drops of rain, Clément bumped into something solid. It was the rocking chair, still afloat and bobbing in the roiling river. Clément grabbed hold of the chair with one hand and used the power of his legs and one free arm to swim with all of his capacity, feeling the current massaging his body as if innocent of harmful intent. When he felt he must have swum far enough from the suckhole, he lifted his head to take a quick look around in the water to get his bearings. The rain was varied now, beating down on him hard and soft by intervals, driving into his eyes, and Clément made his plan to swim to the opposite shore, away from the suckhole. His muscles had begun to ache, and a cramp in his left leg formed a hard knot of pain that set his teeth on edge. When the bank was close, the choppy water came to his aid, pushing him this time toward the safety of solid earth. He never let go of the chair, paddling and swimming as best he could, until his toes gripped the slimy mud that let him know he had reached the bank at last. Clément clawed his way up the slippery slope, aware that he had to keep moving, pulling his knotted, worthless leg behind him. He hung on to the chair, crawling out of the water as if separating himself from the underbelly of the river. He fell back as often as he moved forward, inching his way in stuttering forward progress. He used whatever seemed strong enough to support his weight, cypress knees, branches, palmettos that cut at his hand but propelled him forward, although slowly. He pulled himself closer and closer to safety, away from the reach of the waters that in some spots spilled over the bank completely. At one point he slithered like an alligator on his stomach in the red clay, one hand and arm for pulling, the other for protecting and keeping the chair close to him. At last he came to rest, when he was sure the wet he felt around him was rain and not the river. He closed his eyes for just a minute, to rest and gather strength, but opened them again with a start as he realized that if he did not keep moving, he would curl himself along the forest floor and drift off to sleep. Clément knew well the lay of the land along the banks of Cane River from making so many deliveries for Tessier, but he wasn't exactly sure where he was. He was certain that he was on the left bank instead of the right bank where he needed to be, but it wasn't clear to him how far down he had gone. The sky had ripened into a pale red color as the sun fought to escape, and he was able to make out shapes better than he had before. He looked back in the direction of where he thought the suckhole should be, but he couldn't see it. It had changed its location, or perhaps disappeared entirely. He saw what could have been pieces of smashed wood floating on top of the water near the other bank, but the pouring sheets of rain obscured his view. Even though it was the middle of the day, it was dark and dim, and he wasn't sure of anything. If it was the boat, he thought, he could not have gone back for it anyway. His muscles complained. The spurt that had allowed him to escape had played out, run its course, and it was all he could do to put one foot in front of the other and move himself forward, he and the chair. Incredibly, the chair looked to be whole, except for gouges in the wood he knew he could fix. It was soaked through, as was he, but of the two of them, the chair was in better shape. He walked through the woods uncertainly at first, following the line of the bank, until he came to the splayed live oak tree he recognized as marking the Grenot plantation, on the wrong side of the river. He carried his trophy chair, weary, until he came to Monette's ferry. The regular boatman sat under the protection of his lean-to wrapped in oilskin, a wiry Jean de couleur libre, who bit off a plug of tobacco as Clément approached.
"I need to get to the other side, monsieur. I got caught in the storm."
"I can see that myself. You're lucky.
It's only habit got me out here today. I can get you across, but you tell Monsieur Tessier that's 12.5 cents added to his bill.
There was a posted sign, which Clement could not read, but he knew that it advertised the rates for passage across to the other bank of the river. 25 cents for a man and a horse, $1 for any four-wheeled vehicle pulled by 2 horses, and $1.50 for a loaded wagon or coach with 4 horses, including the driver and passengers. He had been across many times with Tessier, and just as many without him.
"Where are you going?" the boatman asked.
I need to get across to Monsieur Narcisse Fredieu's, and then back home. I lost my load to a suck hole, and the boat is gone.
Only a fool would go out in that storm this morning. By the looks of you, the storm won.
The boatman offered Clement a grimy hand rag, and Clement wiped his face and cleared his eyes. When he pulled back the towel, it was stained with streaks of brownish red, and he cautiously touched the spot at the crest of his cheek where the skin had opened. The gash was tender but not too deep, and still running red. It had missed his eye.
"Well, the river is calm enough now to take you across. Won't charge you extra